Good afternoon, everybody. Oh, let's turn that up a little bit. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Elise Glink. I'm sitting in for Amy Guth today. Normally, you hear me filling in for Steve Bertrand on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and here we are on a Saturday. It's actually kind of nice. The vibe's a little slower, a little more relaxed. We've got a little bit more time. I just want to say a thank you of my own to Kathy and Judy and Kristen Decker, who is an amazing producer. And when I had my own show on Saturday mornings on WGN, Kristen helped me produce that and helped me produce some of the other things that I did. So thank you, Kristen, and Godspeed and all your stuff at Accenture. Kathy and Judy, just thank you, because you're part of the Voices of Chicago and one of the reasons that I pursued radio, because of you. So for those of you who haven't heard me, I am publisher at thinkglink.com, where we specialize in personal finance and real estate information. You can find me on Twitter at Glink, CEO of a company called Best Money Moves, and you can find that at bestmoneymoves.com. And, which I think our first guest is going to be pretty happy about, I actually have a YouTube channel with a whole bunch of videos. Amy Schmittauer is the vlog boss, and she's got a brand new book, her first book, God, there's nothing like a first book, called Vlog Like a Boss, and is the complete guide to video blogging. And she's the creator of the YouTube series Savvy Sexy Social. Now, say that 10 times fast. Amy, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you for having me, Elise. Nice to talk to you.
That's nice to talk to you, too. So tell me a little bit. I love the name Savvy Sexy Social. Of course, those are great keywords, which is the key to anything these days, is to name something what it is and hope that people are searching for exactly that term. So you've got this first book. Tell me why. Tell me a little bit about your YouTube channel.
So the purpose of the channel has always been, for me as a social media marketer, I wanted to educate businesses on how they could wrap their mind around this vehicle that we have to communicate our message. But when I started businesses at the time, it was 2010, 2011, they were just trying to get their mind around having a Facebook page. It wasn't necessarily something they were looking forward to. So I thought, why don't I teach them something while they're having to bootstrap and figure it out? But let's have fun at the same time. So that's the promise I've always made for the channel. It's progressed more into not just social media, but video content marketing, because we know how important video is today, not only on our blogs and websites, but on social media as a whole, as these platforms sort of gravitate toward that type of content. So that's what I do. I try to teach the good word about getting your message out there with these tools in the most effective way.
So it's funny, I started my own YouTube channel back in 2001. It was about 2 weeks after 9/11. And a friend of mine who was already on YouTube at the time, I think he was, you know, an early adopter, it doesn't even go far enough for him. I think the day after some sort of new media is introduced, he was on it. He said, oh, Elise, you have to start making videos, because when you've done a lot of television like I have, TV news, it really lends itself, the skill set lends itself quite well. So one of the things that I like about what you do is you try to make it more understandable for people. Like, video just seems so complicated, and yet it really doesn't have to be. So what are some of the fears that you think hold people back, other than I'm going to look ugly and stupid on camera forever?
Well, that's actually as big a fear as it gets, right? Let's go with some of the preliminary ones that people kind of put at the forefront. First of all, there's the fear of gear, which is a big one for people, because they think my brand is a certain level of prestige. My video needs to represent that well. And in 2017, it's just silly to worry about having to buy a bunch of camera gear when we have smartphones in our pocket that have some of the most incredible video and photo that we're seeing today. So the fear of gear should get knocked down. You can edit on your phone now. You can have a 100% mobile video experience and be able to represent your brand properly. So that should get knocked down.
What do you prefer for your mobile experience? Just if you have an Apple, you just use whatever the Apple stuff is, or if you have, like, I have an Android, so what would I use?
Sure. I think everyone should just use the built-in video camera that comes with the smartphone, because that's going to be the most efficient. But that's as simple as it gets. I mean, you can have a video presence on Snapchat, never do any editing, simply upload video from there to a social network and have a great video presence. On the flip side, uploading that same video you can film with your smartphone to a platform like YouTube is just as good. There are so many great presences online that are done with strictly a smartphone.
Right. And what about editing? You said you could edit online. So I don't know. Does my Android edit online? I mean,
you can. You can absolutely download apps. I personally find to be editing on the phone is a little tedious. It's kind of small to work with, but you can upload everything to what we would call the cloud, but that could be the back end of YouTube. That could be your Dropbox. And I love using tools like YouTube that has a built-in editor for something quick and seamless, dragging and dropping and adding titles and music and transitions. And then there's platforms like Adobe Spark that have this incredible platform simply on the web where you can, again, drag in those video clips and make a really nice piece of video that will grab attention when people see it on their social feeds.
What about the use of keywords and naming things appropriately and kind of getting attention that way? How do you counsel some of your clients?
The biggest thing is to always remember who your customer is and where they are right now, and assuming that they don't know who you are yet, right? Like we're not marketing to people that already know who we are. We are, but that's more of a customer service and then really nurturing that relationship opportunity in addition to what we need to do to get in front of people who don't know who we are. So the biggest thing is what's on their mind right now as it pertains to what you do and your industry. What's on their mind? What keeps them up at night? What are their frequently asked questions? Bottom line, what are they Googling? And how can you show up for that? To give an example, it's a little bit meta in my situation, but as much as I want to counsel people to work on their video content marketing, they may not be thinking about video yet. They might be thinking about how to increase their Twitter following or increase their Facebook engagement. So I make content about that because I know they're already searching for it. And then they get to know me and we get to a point where they say, oh, well, video sounds interesting. How can you teach me about that? How can we work together on that? So think about, where are they right now? That's what your content strategy should be revolved around, because the only way you're going to be discovered is if you get on someone's radar for what they care about. So that's where keywords and headlines really come from. It's just that thought process.
So tell me, Amy, why a book? I mean, it seems so last century.
Yeah, so true. It's so funny because...
I say this because I've written 13 books, so it's not like I haven't written books that I understand.
I get it. I mean, this is come to fruition for me, even though it's so weird. I talk about video and I wrote a book about making video. It's all very awkward. But as a speaker, I just found so many people love to be in that moment, hear the message and take action immediately. And they ask you for a book. So for a long time, I was sort of dragging my feet on this. But who am I to choose the medium? If someone wants to read a book to find out more about how they can do something, if that's their way of learning, I wanted to offer that. I've always been a reader. I didn't think I was going to be an author, but here I am. I guess it's what they want. And so that's really why you do anything, right? The customer asks for something and you gotta give it to them. So I simply was responding to an amazing community of people who said, hey, not only do we want to watch your free videos on YouTube, we want to read what you have to say. And I love that I have this comprehensive guide. And it's very practical that I can hand someone and say, hey, you want to get started? This is the stuff you need to know right now so that we can build on top of that.
So where can we get your book? It's called Vlog Like a Boss, and it's Amy mm-hmm. Schmidtauer. So where can we find it?
You can go to vloglikeaboss.com. And vlog is a tough word for some people, so just think video blog, V-L-O-G, likeaboss.com. All the details are there. There's a special little bonus if you pick up a copy on Amazon. All the details are on that site.
Terrific. Amy, best of luck with your first book. I hope it's not your last. As somebody, again, who's written 13 books, I can say that there's sort of a, just kind of a free-flowing, river that you start to dive into when it comes mm-hmm. to writing books. But we wish you all the best with it. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Elise. I appreciate that.
It's 12:19. This is the Noon Business Hour. I'm Elise Glink. I'm sitting in for Amy Guth, who's out in Las Vegas, one of my all-time favorite people-watching places, for sure. You can find me online at thinklink.com, where I will be happy to answer all of your real estate and finance questions, or at Glink on Twitter or bestmoneymoves.com. Well, we've got Ira Boudway, sorry about that, writer at Bloomberg on the phone right now, and he has written about a company called Quanterix, which is developing tests for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. I'm going to just say this wrong. Let's call it CTE. That's the brain disorder common in NFL players. And what's interesting about this is that this company is backed by the NFL at the moment. And we wanted Ira to come on and tell us all about that. It's a really interesting conundrum for the NFL. Ira, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So we've been hearing more and more over the last few years about CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Did I say that right?
That's right, yeah.
And now there's this, and more is being discovered. We have more and more football players who are donating their brains to science after they die. They're young. It's so traumatic. And they're finding that most have this terrible disease. And so now tell us a little bit about Quanterix and what they're doing.
Sure. So they are part of several companies that are hunting for a way to find this disease while people are still alive. There's no way to diagnose it in the living. And what happens now is that players who have a lot of the symptoms, players who wind up with dementia, memory loss, mood swings, and those things, they are the ones who wind up having their brains donated. And so it's sort of a self-selected group. And a lot of them, it turns out, you know, so far about 90, they find the markers in their brains for this disease, but they can't do it until they get to the autopsy stage, which is obviously too late. So they're looking for biomarkers to do it. And Quanterix has a way to test in the blood for tau, which is a protein associated with CTE. And their first goal is to get to a way to diagnose for concussions, because concussions are actually a clinical judgment, a subjective diagnosis at this point. And they think they can figure out how to diagnose concussions and then potentially down the road also CTE.
So this reminds me of when mad cow disease became this huge deal like 25 years ago. And everybody in Britain, I was living in Britain at the time, we were warned off from eating any meat whatsoever. And it became less of an issue, but still an issue here. But again, until you know, you couldn't really diagnose it until the person had already died. And obviously finding a way to diagnose this sooner is more important. It strikes me that concussions are pretty interesting. I'm hearing more and more about kids younger and younger who are getting concussions being diagnosed, and then kids are missing, you know, 2, 3, 5, 8 weeks of school, and they're very concerned about how these early concussions then play out later on. When you have a football player, they've obviously been playing football since they were, you know, in second or third grade. How does Quanterix aim to dig in and find out or be able to identify those markers sooner?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up mad cow, because the problem there, as with really anything that goes on in the brain, is there's a blood-brain barrier, and it's a very useful thing. It keeps infections out of our brain, but it also makes it really hard to see what's going on in there.
Right.
And so what this technology does basically is it makes the blood test much, much more sensitive, 1,000 times more sensitive than this current standard. And so they're able to detect things in much smaller quantities, and this could have applications in infectious disease, in all kinds of neurodegenerative disease like CTE, Alzheimer's, even for cancer, Parkinson's, a lot of different applications, because it's just anything you want to hunt for, you can find it when there's a lot less of it. And so this has allowed them to start to detect things that they weren't able to see before. And that, in the case of head trauma, what they're really looking for is, and usually what you're looking for is a protein. And they're looking for a specific protein that is in the brain, it's there in a healthy brain, and some of it gets basically dislodged when you get a concussion. And CTE, they think basically what happens is at some point there's a breakdown is triggered, and these proteins start to sort of deteriorate. And so in both cases, that marker is what you're hunting for, and they're able to find it in blood when we really couldn't before. And this will, you know, you're right, it's going to be something where it's going to change, you know, how parents think about letting their kids play, depending on what we find out.
All right. So what's really interesting as a business person and a business reporter for me, and I'm sure for you being over at Bloomberg, is the idea that the NFL is actually involved with Quanterix. Are they financially supporting it as well? I think that's what you had said.
Yeah, they have given them a pair of grants totaling $800,000, which is not a ton of money, but it's helped them because they're a privately owned company. They're looking to go public in the next year, but this is money that helped them further their work for a concussion blood test and also has raised their profile. Roger Goodell mentioned the company in a letter about player safety. They feature, you can see some of the company's machines, the commercial that's been running. The NFL has been running during the playoffs. And so this has made it helpful for the company to go out and raise money, you know, from investors.
But this has to be like a nightmare for the NFL, because if Quanterix is able to spot this earlier and earlier, and we officially recognize just how horrible it is to have your head bashed against somebody else's, you know, fewer people will end up letting their kids play football. I know for myself, I said to my son, who loved football at seventh grade, I was like, I think you should be done because, like, you only have one brain and I can't make another one of you. I'm done.
It's very tricky because I think when it comes to concussion, they really do want an objective test because right now there's a ton of back and forth every time a player gets hurt about how hurt are they, should they be back on, there's concussion protocol, there's are the trainers, you know, really have the player's best interest in mind, and it would just solve all of that and tell you, okay, this player's safe enough to go back on the field. And I think it actually might help reassure a lot of parents, too. It might, okay, this blood marker, this blood test shows they're okay to play. And I think that's why the NFL likes that.
But what hit is the one hit too many, right?
Right. And yes, and that's the question. If they are able to see markers that say this is the onset or this is signs of high risk, this is you're headed toward real trouble here. If they're able to discover that, and if it turns out that they find that in a lot of people who haven't even played that much,
right?
Then I think, yeah, you have a crisis. And for the NFL, basically their approach is they got burned trying to downplay this stuff for a while. And so now they realize that from a public relations perspective, they have to be at least seem to be behind the science. And so they are putting a lot of money behind it. Besides the money into Quanterix, they've put up about $130 million toward different types of research and engineering for better helmets and stuff, and also in neuroscience research. And so, and they say that they're ready to follow the science wherever it leads. And I think their hope is that, one, it won't be as widespread as some people fear, that it won't be every player, because there are players who don't get it. And that's worth noting that, you know, it's not as if anybody who plays football will have CTE. And I think they're hoping that they will not only find out that it's not totally pervasive, but that they will find out ways to treat, prevent, and cure it. And that's possible. If you can diagnose something and figure out why some people get it and other people don't, you can start clinical trials. You can maybe even find things that reverse the damage. And that is sort of their hope. But you're right, it's a big gamble. No one really knows, you know, what is going on inside the brain. And we've only been doing football for a tiny piece of human history. And now science is starting to catch up with, okay, what happens when we send kids out to play this game? What happens when full-grown people play this for years? And it may be something that, you know, changes the game forever. You know, they may have to change the rules in ways that doesn't look like what we will be watching during the Super Bowl.
Well, it's interesting because this would be the really long game for the NFL. I mean, if you think about mad cow disease, they've done now 30 years of testing and they still don't have a cure for it. They can't reverse it. It's, you know, and they haven't poured this kind of money and technology against it yet, the best that I know of. I mean, so few people get it. Football's a much bigger risk. We were on vacation in Aspen earlier this fall and met a guy who was a professional rugby player in, I think, Australia. And he was saying how they just have none of this. They don't have any of the issues that they have concussion issues, but they don't have the kinds of damage issues from old rugby players dying young with these crazy kinds of manifestations that they do with CTE. And he was saying, you know, he thinks that it's really because of the way that they don't play with helmets and padding and all the rest, and they don't really hit each other on the head. And so, to your point, maybe it's just how the game is played that will change the whole story.
I think that's a big part of it. The technology, the rules might change. And you also may see in other sports that they're just behind in terms of knowing what the problems are that they have. I think hockey, soccer, a lot of contact sports are, you know, maybe just haven't had anybody really look yet. But yeah, I think when you look at football, the helmets actually make players sort of weaponized because they don't crack their skulls. They are protected from skull fractures, you know, and that's obviously a good thing, but it allows them to hit much harder and in places that you just never would if you weren't wearing a helmet. And it appears that that is causing this long-term damage.
Well, for millions of moms and dads who are wondering whether they should let their little kids play football, this is going to be a lot of very interesting to watch. And I'm so glad you wrote this story. The company is called Quanterix. And Ira Boudway, is a writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. Ira, are you on Twitter? Can people find you that way?
Yes, it's I Boudway, first initial, last name.
I-B-O-U-D-W-A-Y. Sounds great. Ira, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. It is 1229. This is WGN 720. I'm Elise Klink. Be back in a moment with more of the Noon Business Lunch. Hey, welcome back, everybody. I'm Elise Klink, sitting in for Amy Guth today on the Noon Business Hour. Glad you could join us. Nice Saturday, waving at a lot of people here on Michigan Avenue. You can find me online. My website is thinkglink.com for all your real estate and personal finance questions, or at Glink on Twitter. Or if you're interested in my HR app for financial wellness, bestmoneymoves.com. All right, so moms who don't have kids, who work, this seems like it's not a thing, and yet this has become a really big thing. Lisa Bertagnoli from Crane Chicago Business, chicagobusiness.com, has just written about this. Lisa, welcome to the Noon Business Show.
Oh, hello. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. So what inspired you to highlight this group of working women, the non-mom working women group?
Well, actually, they inspired the story. A while back, I got an email from Kirsten Chernowski, who's one of the women interviewed. She's executive director at Erie House in Chicago. And she said she observed that all the stories about work-life balance concentrate on women with children. And she said, what about us? We have these issues too, and nobody's speaking to our needs and how we can deal with work-life balance.
Because we figure that women, I guess, who don't have kids just have that much more time in their lives. Like, what kind of a balance issue would they have, right? That would be the thinking. What did you actually find?
I found that they have time constraints just like everyone else. And while they don't have families the way most people think of families, you know, a husband and a kid, they do have families. They have networks of people who need love and care. They have parents. They have relatives. So they're trying to fit family into their lives as well, just not the same way. And they do have, they don't have a ton of time. They do have time issues that need to be sorted out.
It's sort of interesting because I think people will just assume that if you don't have kids, of course you're going to stay late. You're going to be the one to stay late. You're going to be the, because you don't have soccer and you don't have, you know, all these other, you don't have to take your kid to the doctor's office. And yet that's an imposition as well.
Well, yeah, I think that women with high level women or women without children in the workplace are kind of invisible because they're always there. They are not leaving early to take the kids to soccer or to the doctor's appointment. They are not selling Girl Scout cookies. They're not doing all the necessary things that parents have to do. So they've kind of become invisible.
So did you find that perception to be true, that they really are invisible and taken for granted? Is it in every case? And what kinds of companies is that true?
Well, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. They are taken for granted, but as they pointed out in the story, they do have more of a chance to success because they can do things that women without children sometimes cannot do. They can be relocated. They can work extra hours. They can travel. So women without children sometimes have a better chance at advancement in the workplace. So
how does the Sheryl Sandberg Lean In thing feel, you know, work? Because for Lean In, it's more like a it takes a village mentality. I read that book and I thought it was really, really insightful in how we all have to support each other in the kind of workplace community. So are you suggesting by that Lean In is something that sort of non-mom working women should do more for each other, or just sort of in general?
Well, I think the women interviewed in my piece realize that women have to support each other all the time. The mommy wars need to be just over and done with.
Okay, what is that? Let's talk about the mommy wars, because I got to tell you, I'm the owner of a business. We have about, I don't know, 8 full-time employees. We don't have a mommy war. I'm the only one with kids, and now I'm an empty nester. So I fall now into this, you know, no kids at home sort of category. But what I do see evidence of mommy wars all over the place.
It was, I think the mommy wars were born, for lack of a better word, in the late 80s, and it was the stay-at-home moms versus the working moms. And no, if we stay home with our children, we're doing a better job. No, if I'm happy because I have a workplace to go to every day, I'm doing better for my children. So that's where I think the mommy wars came from. It was the women who thought that mothers should be home with their children, and women who thought that if you If it made you happy to get a job, you should get a job, because happy women are happy mothers.
Right. And I buy into that. I think everybody should do what makes them really makes themselves feel good and feel happy. Where did you find the women that you interviewed? How did, you know, what sorts of quarters do they represent in your story?
I cover nonprofits for Cranes, and they are all either directly from or involved with the nonprofits world. Three of them head major important organizations, and then Tristan Slemons works for Detroit's corporate responsibility department, so she kind of coordinates volunteer efforts and coordinates Deloitte's corporate giving.
Do you find that the nonprofit sector, what I imagine about this, and my sister is the executive director of a big nonprofit foundation in Chicago, you know, I find that they are typically people who are enormously caring and charitable and giving of their time. So not only do they run a nonprofit or they're involved with nonprofits, but then they sit on boards of other nonprofits to leverage expertise, to create connections in that world, which especially in the state of Illinois now with funding issues, it's so traumatic for everybody. It just feels like there aren't enough hours in the day for that.
Exactly. They are tremendously giving and generous and caring people, and that's one of the reasons they don't have any time, because as they told me when we sat with the roundtable for the story, they're out all the time networking. They're trying to do the best they can for their organizations, and it is more difficult given the funding situation in this state. So, yeah, they're really, really busy, and they take their work home with them.
So how do they... Maybe because they're the heads of these companies, people now have to go to them. But what's the advice for somebody who's in a situation, they're a working, you know, woman, no kids? How do they protect their own time off? And how do they sort of arrange that as they move through their career?
Well, I think they're always tethered. I think they're like the executive of a big for-profit company. You really, really never can, you know, go to that fabled desert island and leave your cell phone at home. You're always connected. And I think the four women I talked to all know each other. They're a very tight network, and they support each other. They told me during the course of the interview that they actually have friends who have children, and they will babysit for their friends, and they'll take care of each other and balance each other. So that they're kind of their own little family in that way.
Well, it's funny because nobody really, according to your story, like everybody that you talked to there, they may not have their own kids, but they've got nieces and nephews they're close to that they, as you point out, babysit for or help support or engage with, or they have siblings that they work with. I was talking to a nurse yesterday, and she's the eldest of five kids, and she was going to visit two of her sisters who are at Eastern Illinois, I think. And so she was saying, you know, ever since I got this job as a nurse, now I go see my, you know, kids' sisters at college, and they're like, oh, could you take us to CVS to buy, you know, we need more shampoo, or we need this, or we need that. And she said, I'm spending my whole weekend going there to take them out and engage with them, and they're a very close family. So she doesn't have her own kids, and yet she said, I feel like I'm, you know, helping to support my sisters who are in college. And I think all of us have siblings, just like everybody has parents or aunts or uncles or elderly relatives they help with.
Yes, indeed. And I think as the birth rates drop, and that's a global thing, I think, and as more people opt not to have children, the definition of family will broaden to include those relationships as primary relationships. Everybody, if you're lucky, you have someone who looks up to you, who wants you to go to CVS with them and, you know, pick out the latest beauty products or whatever. And I actually look forward to the day when the notion of family is broader and bigger.
Yeah, it would be nice. I think it would be nice to have just a generally more inclusive society at the moment, especially one where people seemed a little bit more caring and engaged with other people, shall we say. Lisa Bertagnoli, thank you so much for taking time on your Saturday to come and talk to us. Your stories are at chicagobusiness.com, right? Crane's website?
That's exactly right, chicagobusiness.com.
And what about a Twitter handle? Is there another way people can communicate with you?
I'm at Lisa Burt, and the magazine is at Chicago Business.
That's terrific. Thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks very much. Take care.
All right. It is 12:46 on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Elise Kling, sitting in for Amy Guth, and I'll be back in just a moment with more on WGN 720. Hey, Welcome back, everybody. It's 12:50 on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for Amy Guth, and you can find me online, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com, on Twitter, at Glink. And for those of you who texted wondering where my YouTube channel is, Expert Real Estate Tips, youtube.com/expertrealestatetips. I have more social media. There's Facebook pages. There's all kinds of stuff. So get online and engage. Would love to talk to you. All right. Haley Tsukiyama is on the phone with us right now. Tsukiyama, I hope I said that right. Haley, you there?
Yes. Hi. Thanks for having me. And you said it just fine.
I did. All right. Thank you so much. It's nice to talk to you. Haley's a reporter, a tech reporter at the Washington Post. My syndicated column that I write with my husband, Sam Tamkin, actually appears in the Washington Post on Saturdays, which is kind of fun. Nice to have a fellow colleague in.
Always.
So you talked a little bit in a story recently about how Lyft has benefited, actually, from the anti-Trump backlash that hit Uber this week. So for everybody who did have their head in the sand or was actually, like, had their head completely twisted off their neck by the events of D.C. this week, again, you know, it's been interesting to watch how Uber, the head of Uber, the CEO, was on the CEO special advisory panel and then had to back off because there was such a backlash about him being associated with that in the Trump administration. How has Lyft actually benefited there?
So there is, as you said, because of Travis Kalanick, that's the CEO of Uber, he was on this panel, and then also there was a little dust-up where the New York City cab drivers were on strike to protest the immigration order for an hour. They didn't do any drives, and Uber kind of said, "Oh well, we're not going to do our normal surge pricing, for that time period." So people kind of saw it as an attempt by Uber to break the strike. Now, Uber, of course, says that was not their intention.
Oh no, of course not.
Of course not.
we're also cynical now, right?
That they have acknowledged it, but that combination of things made people really start this Delete Uber campaign. And, of course, you know, people are willing to delete Uber, but they still want the kind of service that Uber provides. So Lyft stepped in, not only kind of seized a good PR moment and said, hey, we're going to donate $1 million to the ACLU over the next 4 years, but then also, kind of made their messaging really good. And so Lyft actually shot up the app charts, and the verdict is still out on how badly Uber was hurt, but we've certainly seen less engagement, and, like I said, Lyft overtook them. So,
well, I saw somewhere that 200,000 people deleted their Uber apps.
Yes, I've also seen that. I haven't been able to verify that myself, but I would believe that a lot of my friends, just speaking anecdotally, a lot of my friends did, in fact, delete their Uber apps.
Yeah, I have to say, this is, so to dig a little bit deeper, if you've been in a cab or an Uber or whatever lately, I mean, every time I go into an Uber, there's somebody who seems to be from, somewhere in the Middle East. That just happens to be my experience. Any number of countries. I don't know if it's the big seven, but it could be any number. And there are many, many immigrants who drive cabs, drive for Uber, drive for Lyft, are doing these kinds of jobs. And this the way that our political world is now structured, I could imagine that this is just the kind of torrent that this caused amongst the drivers of Uber and Lyft and how unsupported they feel.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree. Both Uber and Lyft, I think Uber to a larger degree because it's the more well-known company.
Sure.
They both face a lot of questions about, sort of how they treat their drivers, whether they take advantage of these, populations that can come in. A lot of drivers drive for both. So it is kind of, I've been trying to find a driver, but, I'd be interested to know if, how they look at it and if they're saying, well, maybe I'll also just drive for Lyft instead of driving for Uber.
How is it? Are you seeing, the tech community has started to have a very strong response, the CEOs from the tech world, and I know this is what you generally cover. So just in general, when you're covering stories about the tech world kind of rising up and feeling just generally revulsed about what's going on in D.C. and they don't want to, they want to fight against this, there's such a liberal, free society kind of tendency for all of these companies. They seem, what I saw another crazy statistic that like 80% of all unicorns were either started by immigrants or have as their head of product immigrants, it feels like this is a war that you could see the tech industry fighting.
I think that's definitely true. I mean, you know, I've talked on record and off record to a lot of people in the tech world this week, and, you know, they're all saying, well, look, sort of tech by its very nature is a global industry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because the U.S. tech economy or the U.S. tech industry is sort of at the top of its game, you know, compared to other countries around the world, they draw from a global pool of talent. And so sort of more than any other industry, you know, major industry, they are interested in globalization, in connectivity. And so you can really see that, you know, they have such a high percentage of their own employees. They're looking after their own business interests. You know, it's not all politically motivated, though it is to a great extent, but it also is just sort of built into the nature of their business that immigration and data and all kinds of things have to be free-flowing across the globe.
Right. I mean, originally when the Internet came out, the whole push was for free information everywhere, always, and Google's principle was to organize information online for everybody to access.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it's a very interesting thing. Going forward over the next couple of weeks, anything that you're particularly tracking either with regard to this story or other stories in the kind of political realm? I think, by the way, the Washington Post is doing an absolutely amazing job of coverage, and I have just been totally enjoying it. So just going to, and I do write for them, and I think it's just important to support all kinds of really interesting, good, solid writers. So thanks to the Post for all of that. But what are you particularly covering over the next couple of weeks? What are you watching for?
Well, I mean, I think so. The next step that we're all watching for, particularly on the tech staff, is, you know, okay, so all these CEOs have spoken out. They're protecting their own employees. The question is, you know, how many more of them are going to join these lawsuits? You know, how much lobbying are they going to do? Sort of, you know, both Apple and Amazon have said they're looking at their legal options for fighting this ban. So, you know, kind of figuring out what that means. So, you know, just sort of seeing how they put their money where their mouths are, because obviously they also want this administration to favor the tech industry. They had a really good under Obama. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see sort of what level of dissent they're willing to go to.
And here we are, day 15. Haley Tsukiyama, thank you so much for being with us today on the Noon Business Hour.
Thanks for having me.
We really appreciate it. You can see more of Haley's work at thewashingtonpost.com. 57 minutes past 12, and I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for Amy Guth. We'll be back with Crosstalk with John Williams next on WGN.